Journalist Katie Butler's father was in his late 70s, but was vibrant and healthy when he had a crippling stroke. That started him on an accelerated decline, and for Butler, a regular schedule of flights from California to her parents' home in Connecticut. After his stroke, her father incurred a minor hernia while he was doing physical therapy. His doctor decided Jeffrey Butler needed surgery and also recommended a pacemaker. This proved to be a pivotal moment for Katie Butler and her parents. As she noted years later, quote, "A sense of urgency combined with the assumption that the treatment offered has no alternatives and no downsides are common ingredients in medical decisions, later regretted, involving the fragile elderly." Butler chronicles her father's subsequent slide into dementia, near blindness, and misery in her book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. It's part memoir, part medical history, and part spiritual guide. I spoke with Butler earlier this year in her home in Mill Valley, California. I asked her to describe the impact a seemingly minor medical decision to install a pacemaker would have on her family.
It looked at the time like a no-brainer. Of course, we have to do this. But what happened was that my father declined from a plateau that was bearable to one that became simply unbearable. So that piled up on top of the stroke damage came dementia, came the inability to even walk alone to the neighborhood pool and do exercises, blindness as a result of macular degeneration, couldn't even read the newspaper. And so these very delicate quality of life decisions that are moral decisions at least as much as medical decisions, suddenly the balance started to shift. And my father, unfortunately, lived into a time when his life became a curse to him rather than a blessing.
So someone casually hearing your story would be shocked that you and your mother pushed to have your doctor deactivate your father's pacemaker. Why did this seem like the only humane option? How did it get to that point? How long did it take?
Well, it took 4.5 years to get to that point. And I do realize that to an outsider, it could seem heartless. But my mother and I loved my father more than any other man on earth. And we spent more time taking care of my father than anyone else on earth. I feel that we as a culture think that the only loving thing to do is to prolong, and take any medical intervention that might give another couple weeks or months or even years. But I frame it very differently now, having gone through it. I think in terms of we wanted to remove all barriers to a natural death. We were faced with a technology that has erased the line between extending a life and extending a dying. And we are not the only people in that position. People are facing the similar kind of choice over things like dialysis for someone who is demented, a feeding tube, even antibiotics for someone who is suffering from multiple devastating, painful chronic illnesses from which there is no recovery. So I think we need to do some very serious thought about our moral language for the end of life, because the nature of the end of life has changed completely because of medical technologies.
You do a great job highlighting that in the book. And your father, his dementia was quite advanced at this point. How could you be sure when you decided you wanted to pursue this path, this is what he wanted too?
Well, my father said 4 very important things in what I call the gray zone, which was the time between the first stroke and his actual death 6.5 years later. He first said, "I don't know who I am anymore." A year later, he said, "I'm not going to get better." And that was after working very hard at rehab. And finally, he said to my mother, "I'm living too long." That was a very clear statement.
He had trouble articulating a lot, but you felt fairly confident that could he come back, see where he was in his current self, that's what he would want.
Well, yeah, because he said, "I'm living too long," at a point where he'd had massive stroke damage, couldn't fasten his own belt or usually finish a sentence. But he did say, "I'm living too long." And that was at a point where he still had quite a few of his marbles. Now, 3.5 years down the line, he was suffering immensely more. And at that point, He didn't even know to take off his slippers before he put on his shoes. So the suffering of both him and my mother, and I think my mother's suffering also ought to be considered part of the equation. I really think that once a family member enters what I call the gray zone, the whole family is the patient, not just the person who is the one who's had the terrible event. Because what difference does it make if you have simply offloaded suffering from one person and moved it to another? And in the case of my father and my mother, extending my father's life also meant creating immense health burdens and stress burdens on my mother. And I don't think those should be simply sort of put on the shelf and not really considered as part of what we need to be looking at in terms of what medical care should be doing.
You never succeeded in getting the pacemaker turned off. Why was it so difficult?
It's fascinating because legally, since 1989, the Supreme Court said that we each have the right, moral and legal, to request the withdrawal of any medical treatment. Doesn't matter if it's good for you, bad for you, or you're in conflict with your doctor about it, that's your right. But practically speaking, these advanced technologies are a lot easier to say yes to and a lot harder to get turned off or deactivated. It's just a practical question of power. You have to be very sophisticated or fairly sophisticated to know how to turn off a pacemaker. On hospice units, they do in fact simply use magnets and put them over the chest, and that will in fact deactivate a pacemaker, but that's not actually the preferred method. It's much more technical and computery than that. So it's also true with feeding tubes. It's also, I think, morally and emotionally easier to say, no, I do not want to give my demented mother who is suffering a feeding tube that may prolong her life, but actually may create enormous, horrible, painful side effects for her. It's easier to say, no, I don't want to start this than it is to say, I want to end that. It may not be different legally or morally, but it feels so different on a visceral level. It was tremendously difficult for my mother and I to say, call this cardiologist and say, will you deactivate this?
And he recoiled in horror at first.
He absolutely recoiled in horror. And when I interviewed him for the book, he said it would have been like putting a pillow over your father's head. Okay, now that's wrong. His own cardiology associations have created statements saying this is neither assisted suicide nor euthanasia. He's completely wrong about that. But that on a gut level, I sympathize with how he feels.
How did your father finally die?
My father got pneumonia. And by then, my mother had completely rebelled against the medical system. She had refused to subject him to further tests and further drugs that had their own side effects. And when he got pneumonia, which they used to call the old man's friend, she did not take him in to get antibiotics. So we quite consciously chose not to give him antibiotics, and he died on a hospice unit.
So it only came through a very deliberate effort on her part and your part. If you had followed more of the common path, God only knows how long he might still be alive.
Well, this is the frightening thing about where we're at, the nightmarish thing about where we're at, which is there's almost always another treatment until the body completely breaks down on multiple levels. And nurses have been known to cry in the corner of intensive care units because they feel they are putting these very old people through absolutely unbearable suffering for no reason. So yes, we could have given my father antibiotics. Maybe he could have gone in the hospital and come out again, only to die another time. And my question is, how many fatal illnesses do we have to put these poor old people through before we accept that dying is a natural process and that when we go along with it, it can be relatively painless? People can have a chance to give their last words and their final blessings. They can have their families around them. They can do the things that are really meaningful for the end of life. And if we just fight the inevitable, we deprive people of very important emotional and moral tasks of the end of life, spiritual tasks of the end of life.
This is Women's Focus on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamarick, and I'm speaking with Katie Butler, author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Her book explores her own journey with her aging parents as her father slipped into dementia after a stroke. She and her mother sought to give him a peaceful death against a battery of medical technologies, including a pacemaker. But the book is also an exploration of the systems that brought us collectively to a place where such a natural death is very difficult to achieve.
You know, we're in your office in Mill Valley, your home office, and I was reading the obituaries today in the San Francisco Chronicle. I noticed that there was one for a gentleman who I think had a was well known in Half Moon Bay and had a jazz bar. And it said he died with his little beanie or beret on, smoking his pipe, looking out his window at his desk at the Pacific Ocean. I would say most people would say that's a good death. It's fairly rare now, right?
It's very rare. And I've heard a number of doctors say to people, don't call 911. Whatever you do, don't call 911. Because once you call 911, you're in the emergency system that will revive you, that will put you into the intensive care unit. I think we need an 811 system so that when someone collapses at home, when they've already got a do not resuscitate order, they know what they want for the end of life. If we had the 811 system, a palliative care nurse could come to the house and reassure the family members and make sure that this dying is peaceful and that pain is controlled.
And even after your father died, his pacemaker kept working.
Correct. We tried even on the hospice unit. We said, could we get this thing turned off? And they called the cardiology service, and the person who was on duty for the weekend said no. So even at this absurd length, which is you're on a hospice unit, everybody has accepted you are dying, we still had trouble. It was more of a bureaucratic slip-up, a communication problem. But again, these advanced devices create a lot of these communication problems.
Your narrative is deeply personal, and you delve into the unresolved emotional issues between you and your parents, your struggle to find some kind of spiritual comfort, but it also touches on very universal truths. You write that your mother had become one of the 29 million unpaid, politically powerless, and culturally invisible family caregivers who take care of someone over 74, and that it destroyed your mother's moral fiber and corroded her soul. It's very strong language. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. My mother was a decisive, caring, hardworking person. She was also quite impatient. When my father had his stroke, her entire life turned upside down. She had no time for things of her own, such as sewing or gardening or hobbies or friends. She was at some points almost a 24-hour-a-day caregiver. And she was absolutely committed to not putting him in a nursing home. And the cost to her was absolutely immense. The only way she could function was to get up very early in the morning, do an hour of meditation and yoga before he got up, and the rest of her time she was at his beck and call, and it got worse and worse as he got more and more demented. So there were times when she yelled at him. I'm sure it affected her own health.
You note that in the book, actually, there's been some studies of caregivers of their DNA that it shortens lifespans.
Yeah. People who are long-term caregivers for people with dementia or autism, they have a shortening of their telomeres, which is the tail end of your DNA. And that is correlated with how healthy you remain as you get older. She ended up with congestive heart failure and two leaky heart valves. And again, there's research that people who are in stressful relationships have more calcification of the heart. So probably quite directly broke and affected her own heart. Her mother lived to be 92. She died at 85.
You look at the economic underpinnings driving these kinds of decisions. Talk about the differences, for instance, between the financial compensation for your father's primary care doctor, who might have spent time talking with you about the pros and cons of a pacemaker versus the doctors who implanted the pacemaker?
The pacemaker operation cost about $7,500. The bulk of it went actually to the manufacturer of the pacemaker. Another chunk went to the hospital, and another chunk went to the surgeon. The surgeon was paid about seven times as much per hour as the family doctor is paid. So while the family doctor would have gotten about $50 to have a very in-depth conversation with my parents about whether the pacemaker was a good idea, and the surgeon who did the surgery got about $700 for about the same length of time. So you see, the system is biased toward expensive, highly technological cures, so-called cures. And it is biased against time, trust, talk, the very, very crucial elements of what is being called slow medicine. And that is crucial, especially for very old elderly people. Because when you get very old like this, you're like Humpty Dumpty. And a bad surgery or an unnecessary surgery can really tip you over the cliff into a much poorer quality of life. And so these choices become much more subtle. None of them are no-brainers. And you need a really good family doctor to do that. So I looked at in the book, what are the drivers? Because I consider that we have an epidemic of unnecessary suffering now occurring on the way to the deathbed. And it's driven by the economics, at least in part. I mean, it's driven in part by the fact that we, as family members, don't want to face death, and we're not realistic about the limits of medicine. It's driven by identical factors within medicine itself. But it's also driven by the lobbying, the politics, and the economics. The pacemaker was invented in about 1958. They didn't think there was going to be much of a market for it until 1965, when Medicare went in and started to pay for it. And suddenly it went from being this very exotic device for a very few, very sick people, to a massive market. And companies that make pacemakers and defibrillators are tremendously profitable. They often average 20% returns year after year after year, like double that of the rest of the S&P 500. And it's almost like guaranteed money because the government pays the bills. There are very few restrictions or oversight as to whether it's being appropriately used or not. And so they, of course, have giant lobbies in Washington. And anytime Medicare attempts to bite back on the amount of reimbursement for these over-reimbursed products, there's a huge lobbying campaign. And these huge lobbying campaigns tend to be extremely successful.
Now, you went to one of these conventions here in San Francisco that had all these paid for by these companies, including the one who made your father's pacemaker, lots of money, and addresses by doctors. Talk about the difference in that vibe versus what you had personally experienced with your family. There seemed to be a huge disconnect between these worlds.
There was a huge disconnect. It was May, and it was the Heart Rhythm Society's annual convention in San Francisco. Every stair riser had the name of like St. Jude Medical or Medtronic Foundation on it. At every stair riser, there were banners, even things like the place where you charged your laptop, that was sponsored by a medical company. So the mood and the exhibit hall, same thing. It was like the biggest Apple store on earth or the biggest Carnival Midway, and nothing but loops of TV shows running, showing all these incredible products. And then, of course, they also had very scholarly presentations that were highly technological because all of these devices are very technological. There were two worlds there. There was a commercial world and there was a technological world. But what I didn't experience much of was a human world. It's not like it wasn't there at all. I mean, I did go to one talk, and the talk was about putting defibrillators and pacemakers in people who were also on dialysis. And this electrophysiologist from the VA system stood up and basically said, "We got to think about what we're doing here." And it was the first really human voice that I had heard at this convention. It was almost like you were flooded with commercial imagery. And this is the sea in which cardiologists swim. And I don't think they're even aware of the degree that they're getting a meta message. And the meta message is technology is always good. Prolonging so-called life is always a good idea. So there's no voice for someone like me, the family member, the aged person themselves that is struggling to balance or to articulate the point at which an intervention is actually not welcomed. And when quality of life is so low that prolonging it is actually not what is wished for.
If you just joined us, this is Women's Focus on KUNM, and I'm Megan Kamarick. You're listening to an interview I did with journalist Katie Butler earlier this year in California about her book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Butler chronicles her experience dealing with her father's slide into dementia after a stroke and how his life was prolonged for years because of a quick decision to install a pacemaker. She also traces the path of how our medical system has become overly reliant on sophisticated technologies that make it very difficult for families to make decisions that could allow for a natural, peaceful death.
I was shocked, you actually, when you delve into the whole history of the pacemaker, it got so bad there were actually a Senate subcommittee hearing in the early 80s because there were kickbacks going to doctors. And you interviewed a surgeon who wanted to remain anonymous, but he supervised his mother-in-law's emplacement of a pacemaker. He watched the company rep hand an envelope to the surgeon who did the procedure. After it was done, it had a gold watch in it. That was shocking.
It was absolutely shocking to me. And what's even more shocking is that was the 80s, but these things kind of come in waves because there's so much money being made. And it's so each implantation is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars to the cardiology system. So it's almost inevitable that one way or another, there will be attempts to get the money to flow down from the companies into the hands of the cardiologists, the ones who are making the decisions whether or not to put in these products. So there was a whole new scandal a couple of years ago in the Midwest where there were, again, essentially kickbacks to doctors for joining a registry that was following their patients. And so the charge was by a registered nurse who worked for St. Jude Medical that the company was doing most of the work and the cardiologist was simply supplying registers of names. And the company was even doing the Medicare billing for these doctors. And the doctors were being paid $2,000 per patient for the names that they gave for this registry. So this lawsuit also said that one of the device sales reps had a $250,000 expense account to wine and dine doctors, that doctors were sent on hunting trips and trips to Las Vegas. And they were, the amount of funding was just extraordinary. So it hasn't disappeared. It just takes new forms.
You cite that about 3/4 of Americans want to die at home, surrounded by loved ones, but only about 1/4 of us do. And about 1/4 of or 1/4 of Medicare's annual outlays, which is upwards of $600 billion, goes to medical care in the last year of life. What kind of impact has this all had in terms of how we as a society now approach death?
Well, I think in essence, people say they want to die at home, but they don't know how to get from A to B. A lot of people never get beyond saying, take me out and shoot me. And take me out and shoot me is not an end-of-life plan. And if you don't have an end-of-life plan, you will be subjected to someone else's end-of-life plan. And unfortunately, the major forces in medicine are to do, 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 and only stop when a family member or the person themselves says stop. But most lay people don't know that. They defer their moral authority to the medical system and hope that decisions will be made that are in their best interests. And frankly, it's luck of the draw. Because if you get what they call in the medical system a cowboy, which is a person who will just do anything, you're in bad hands. If you're lucky, you may get in the hands of a very wise and caring doctor who says something like, I think we should refer you to a palliative care program. We want to maximize your quality of life without necessarily extending the weeks and hours of your life itself. Because unfortunately, as you get to the end of your life, those two goals can be in conflict. That if you keep trying to squeeze out the last couple of weeks, they may be a very, very painful 2 weeks. Whereas if you focus on quality of life, you may have a much more beautiful end of life and death. And you may actually, ironically enough, even get more time. But if you don't shift your focus, you are really increasing the chance that you will go into this series of what I call Hail Mary surgeries. That are desperate attempts to postpone the inevitable and actually create more suffering than they prevent.
Now, in some cases, radical interventions, they actually can extend life and bring quality of life.
Well, the irony is that people who are in hospice or palliative care often outlive the people who are getting aggressive treatment, especially, for example, in cancer. So to throw in a little bit about cancer, 70% of people who are getting non-curative chemotherapy, in other words, chemotherapy that is only expected to extend their life, it's not a cure, 70% of them think they have a possibility of being cured, even though their doctor knows that there is absolutely no chance of that. Okay? Now, perhaps the most tragic thing is that the doctor will get 6% markup of the price of the chemo. So that is an incentive to do chemo even if chemo is not working, and it's even an incentive to do the most expensive chemo. Mm. And it's tragic because if that same doctor takes an hour to talk to you and your family about the fact that studies show that no more chemo is more than unlikely to help you at this point, he'll essentially be paid close to nothing. He'll be paid that $50 for an office visit. So these are what they call perverse incentives. And so my book does go into how this is shaped behind the scenes. And my hope is that it will help people reclaim their moral authority and realize that they need to make decisions based on what are their family values and their spirituality and how do they want to approach the end of their lives.
You know, you mentioned the idea that you get paid an office visit for having these discussions. Now, when the Affordable Care Act was under debate, there was this idea of changing that, giving doctors more incentive to have these discussions. What became then, in the highly charged political atmosphere, death panels.
Exactly.
So it didn't get funded.
Yes, it was $200, and it became framed as death panels. And what's disheartening is that nobody really spoke up for the other side of the coin. I've spoken to a lot of doctors since the book came out, and I know that there is huge uneasiness within medicine about what people are being put through in intensive care units, in dialysis, and especially with feeding tubes when people have dementia and are really dying. But everyone's afraid to speak up. And I think that's one of the virtues of the book, because I wrote Knocking on Heaven's Door as an outsider. I'm just a family member and a journalist and a good researcher, but I'm not a doctor. I'm not in the system. And so it's made it easier for me to call out what is going on here. And we need more very frank voices about the torture that people are being put through at the end of life as a result of a lack of clarity about what they would and wouldn't want.
This is Women's Focus on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamerick, and I'm speaking with journalist Katie Butler, author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Butler tells the harrowing journey of her father's stroke, then descent into dementia. She also explores emerging alternatives to the high-tech medical technologies that promise to extend the length of our lives, but not necessarily the quality.
You mentioned palliative care as a bright spot in all of this, and you also brought up slow medicine. What are those? Talk about those.
So palliative care is not a death-oriented practice. It is oriented towards maximizing quality of life, even if you have a chronic illness and a chronic worsening illness. You're not necessarily dying. but you can really use a shift in what they call goals of care in medicine. In other words, we're not focused on curing you because that's not possible, but we are focused on things like rehab, keeping you functional, keeping you happy, dealing with the emotional fallout in your family, making sure that you have a good plan for a good end of life, and that medical decisions are made with those kind of goals in mind. I had a wonderful thing I saw on the internet a couple days ago, and it's a doctor, a palliative care doctor, talking to a woman who is dying. She does have cancer, and he asks her, what would a good day look like for you? And that's a crucial palliative care question. How can we give you a good day? Now, in her case, she was a jazz singer, so it was singing again. And there's beautiful footage of her singing in her hospital bed, which she hadn't done for years. I know another guy who had congestive heart failure, and he had a defibrillator, which he asked to be turned off because he said he had no quality of life. He was ready to die. And so he was moved to a palliative care program. And the palliative care doctor said basically the same thing. What would be a good day for you? And he said, going down into the basement to my wood shop and making toys for children to give out to kids in the neighborhood. And I can't do that anymore because I'm too short of breath. So they put him on oxygen. And now he can go back down to the basement and make these toys. And he no longer feels like dying tomorrow.
How hard is that? That seems like... Anyway.
It feels like a no-brainer. But again, it's not reimbursed. A palliative care doctor who works full-time on the basis of getting reimbursements, fee-for-service reimbursements, makes about $40,000 a year. People can only do it if they have a salary from a hospital or a university teaching position. We denigrate care and we overpay for cure. And that feeds into slow medicine. Slow medicine is like the equivalent of the slow food movement. It's quality over quantity. It's taking time with a patient so you really understand their situation and their health needs and their body. It's making careful medical decisions. If you have a careful, long conversation with someone and give a full physical and actually touch them, you're going to be able to save them an enormous number of invasive tests that may or may not be helpful. Slow medicine is a growing movement. It started in Italy by cardiologists in Italy. And it's spread to the U.S., and it's a growing voice, a growing counterculture within medicine that is trying to bring humanity and the lost art of healing back into medicine and de-emphasize the quick fix technological test or treatment that can be extremely destructive in people who are fragile and aging.
Your book started as a New York Times Magazine article, which was one of the fourth most downloaded that year. You clearly touched a chord with many people. What's been the impact on the medical establishment?
The most surprising good thing that's come out of writing the book has been the response from within medicine. I find that everywhere, including hospitals that have frankly terrible records for end-of-life care, over-treatment at the end of life, have invited me to come and speak because there are forces within every hospital that are horrified by how far in the wrong direction this has gone. The most amazing thing was that I spoke at a hospital, a wonderful safety net hospital. And after I spoke, their leadership committee met and they made a change in one of their end-of-life protocols. They made a decision that from now on they would have a palliative care consultation before they put a feeding tube in anybody. And this was a change that someone within the hospital, in authority in the hospital, had been trying to have happen for years. But because I came in and I'm this outsider voice, I'm this family voice saying, hey, we families don't want this either. I think it's giving people more moral courage within the system. So there are definitely forces for change within hospitals, but they're up against the power of the money and the technologies. But I think there's a building movement that's starting to develop a language with each other about what's wrong and what needs to happen to change it.
Do you see any changes coming because of the Affordable Care Act?
Unfortunately, the Affordable Care Act is more focused on making sure that people are insured than it is on dealing with issues like overtreatment. And partly it's because of the whole death panel debate. I think maybe they figured they've got to do this one step at a time. There are some changes in the law, such as hospitals now get penalized if someone gets rehospitalized very soon after first hospitalization. And so that is increasing the pressure on making hospitals safer places, not sending people home too early, making sure they have a good situation to go back to and they understand their discharge instructions. So all of these incredibly simple things like getting doctors to wash their hands in hospitals, lowering rates of hospital infections, all of these things, there are now some economic punishments to hospitals for not doing them. But these larger issues of overtreatment and putting a defibrillator in someone who's 4 months from dying, and that's a $100,000 treatment, these Hail Mary surgeries in the last year of life, we have yet to come to a point where either hospitals create protocols or the funding people create protocols that say, you got to have a second opinion before you do this.
After going through all this, your mother chose a very different path. She was advised to have heart valve replacement surgery, and she refused. Talk about that.
She didn't want anything that looked anything like my father's last 6.5 years, which involved not being able to finish a sentence and not being able to take care of himself. She declined open heart surgery. She knew that if she didn't have it, she had a 50-50 chance of dying within 2 years. She went home. She cleaned out the basement and told the person who helped her that she didn't want to leave a mess for her kids. She then had a heart attack. And again, she was pressured intensely to have open heart surgery. I felt like I had to essentially beat the doctors off with sticks to get her wishes honored. And I had a conversation with her where I basically said, we're grasping at straws. And she said, it's hard to give up hope. But 4 hours later, she called me back and she said, I want you to give my sewing machine to a woman who really sews, because it's a Bernina. It's all metal. It has no plastic parts. And that was just so characteristic of her. And because she had some forewarning that her death was coming, she was able to say to me, cherish Brian, who is my long-term partner. I love Brian. I love Brian for what he's done for you. So she was able to really give her blessing to my relationship. She was able to clean up her relationship with one of her sons. And so she died a very clean death. I mean, it wasn't a perfect death. She died too soon for my taste. I really didn't get to say my goodbyes fully.
How old was she?
She was 84, nearly 85. But she definitely died the death she chose and not the death anybody else had in mind. And she died very characteristically of her because she was definite, she was decisive, and she had no desire to be dependent on anybody.
You write that unless we create new rites of passage to help prepare for death, long before it comes, we will remain vulnerable to the commercial exploitation of our fears and to the implied promise that death can forever be postponed. How has going through this with your parents, writing this book, changed your view of your own eventual death?
Well, I'm still a little vague on it. I do hope that I have some forewarning. I do hope I have time to do what my mother did, which was essentially renounce living too long. I hope there's someone there to hold my hand. I hope I get to give my last blessings and ask for forgiveness in whatever ways I need to. And I have, of course, signed a living will and durable power of attorney. And I've written with it a very long letter that explains that if I have dementia, I want comfort care only. I do not want my life in any way artificially prolonged. And that I feel that way, not only for my own sake, but for the people who love me and take care of me. I mean, I'm now still a fully competent human being. And I can make a decision that's based on empathy for others. And when I descend into dementia, I probably will have no empathy for others and what they're suffering. And I don't want my medical decisions made by that shred of a person who's left. our old religions used to prepare us spiritually for this. In the 1450s, the best-selling book was called Ars Moriendi, The Art of Dying, and it was translated from Latin into all the various languages of Europe. It was a scenario for the deathbed, and it provided prayers that the people surrounding you could say to you to reassure you on your deathbed. So these rites of passage existed. They were very laid out. They were easy to visualize. The struggles of the deathbed. And we don't have that anymore. And I think it's very important that we develop it. My father, for instance, died on a hospice unit. He was an agnostic. He hadn't been to church in 40 years. But when the chaplain came by and offered him last rites, I asked her to do it. And it was tremendously relieving and reassuring for me. Even though I don't believe exactly in the Anglican picture of heaven, I don't believe in that. But there was something very reassuring about being part of a community and saying goodbye to my father, turning him over to the forces of good in the universe, however we may conceive them. And I think it's vital that we all imagine rites of passage for ourselves. And they have to be secular rites. Let them be secular rites. But there are ways to make this beautiful, meaningful, and sacred, and it will relieve our souls.
Thank you so much, Katie.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Katie Butler is the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. You can find out more about her at katiebutler.com. If you want to hear parts of this interview again, go to kunm.org and search for Women's Focus. You'll find a bonus track there as well, where Butler discusses the last two chapters of her book, which outline resources and guidelines for thinking through end-of-life decisions. I'm Megan Kamrick, and this is Women's Focus on KUNM.